I help parents become the confident leaders that I say our kids crave us to be. And I've been doing this for 30 years, and I've worked with kids, just mostly kids, the first 20. But really, I discovered that when we can help the parents and empower the parents and lift them up and validate and acknowledge and affirm the parents, we create confident kids.
Welcome to Parenting Teens Today with Jessie LeBeau.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us here. I am here with the infamous, the amazing, the one and only Jackie Finneman. How are you doing?
I'm great, Jessie. Happy to be here. Got a little cold, so I'm a little nasally today, but otherwise all good.
I appreciate you powering through.
It's just what I do. Are we lagging?
A little bit, but we'll be good. We'll cut it. It'll be fine. So I'm excited to talk with you about your experiences, talk with you about your journey with your own kids, with your practice, with your background in mental health. When people ask you what it is that you do, what do you say to them? Man, I love that. And I feel like I am on that same journey with you right now. Because for me, it started with going and speaking and sharing my story and meeting lots of people. And then it was like, okay, we need to do more than just a fun day, a fun hour assembly at a school. We need to have a program for them, right? And we need to work with them and kind of hold their hand and walk them through finding their passion, writing goals, getting all these life lessons. But then you realize so much of it has to do with what's going on in the home, in their relationship with your parents. So how did you come to that realization after doing 20 plus years working directly with the kids to being, all right, this is why it's important to work with the parents?
Yeah, first of all, I have to say that what you are doing for kids is definitely uber super important, even when we don't have parents on board. And that's exactly why, because you're getting into the schools and you're reaching those kids who maybe don't have a great life at home. And you're giving them that hope and that encouragement and the skills and the belief in themselves. So awesome. Love everything that you do, Jessie. So incredibly
grateful.
Thank
you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, to be connected with you. You are authentic to the core, and I'm all about you. So for 20 years as an in-home mental health practitioner, never a therapist, I never wanted to be licensed. I always have had this drive since, you know, little girl helping my mom out at home with, you know, all the kids and the daycare and everything. I wanted to help the parents. I've just felt like anything we can do to encourage them and support them. I don't know why as a little girl that was such a big deal for me. But then as getting into the mental health world and working with kiddos, I just noticed the strain and the stress on the parents. So I was like, oh, if I can put everything into this kid and I can really help them with their behavior and learn some skills to increase their self-esteem and do all those things, I'm going to do a ton of good for them, right? But I was learning more and more that in the home, the parents, even when after I would leave, the parents were struggling and the kids were struggling. So I'm like, I got to get into this relationship between the two of them. And so then I started doing some more coaching with parents. But the problem is the system changed. The mental health model went to medical model. And that was back in the early 2000s. And I will tell anybody who is making the rules in the world today, that was one of the biggest disservices we could have done for the mental health field, is to move it to medical model. We need to be able to support not just the child who's struggling, but the parent, and with treatment plans and diagnosing kids in order to get them services, right? We have to give them a mental health diagnosis like ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, anxiety or depression. That's a part of it, but we need to somehow make sure that we're incorporating the whole family into that, or the parents, the people that are involved into that. And so what ended up happening is that I couldn't see parents without kids being present. Now, I'm trying to coach a parent on how to respond to their child's unwanted or harmful behavior, right? And the kid's in the room. And I just did not like that for two very big reasons. Number one, I thought it made the parent look weak and unknowledgeable and unsafe in some situations with kids, right? And on the other side of that, I didn't want the kid in there when the mom or the dad was talking about all their frustrations or their anger or their worry about the child. I thought the child cannot be hearing this. So that was really difficult. And it was then I plowed through. I ended up becoming the coordinator for the agency, you know, supporting and coordinating over 80 therapists and county or and counselors in a 32 county radius. I was driving all over the place. And I thought, why am I working in this system that, yes, has some great benefits, but is not fitting or feeding my passion or my drive? So, but by the grace of God, a goldfinch in a song, I always say, and my 8-year-old at the time who said, yeah, Mom, of course it's God telling you to do this. I left that 20-year career and started my company to be able to help parents be those confident leaders that our kids crave us to be.
Wow. Yeah, I can't imagine doing that with the kids in the room. Mm-hmm. That has been so difficult because, like you said, it's going to make them look like they are weak. They don't know what's going on. They're not going to be able to be open and honest and vulnerable. And you're like, yeah, this is what's really struggling with them. So I'm glad that you got out of that and you're able to work with them and have those conversations behind closed doors so that there can be more trust and honesty. And when you made that transition and you were able to have these types of conversations with parents, mm-hmm. what kind of results were you able to see? Was it just astounding, like night and day, or were you still able to do pretty well in the old model?
Yeah, I really noticed that. In fact, I think there's way more success with the kids' behavior and the challenges when the parents shift their mindset over what the problem is and even like what their responsibility as the parent is to support their child through the behaviors or the problems or the challenges that they're having. So my model has even changed from when I first left and started this company, which at the time in 2013, when I did start the company's Hello World, the brand is No Problem Parenting, I have shifted. I started working only with families who had kids with attachment disorders, breaks in separation, early life, abuse, neglect, medical pain, that kind of stuff. And then about 4 years, so I was only working with those families, parents. And then after about 4 years, parents were saying, well, if you can help those parents with really significant, challenging, like rejection of love and attention and, you know, kids who don't respond to traditional parenting, why can't you help me in my day in, day out challenges, you know, with my neurotypical kids? And I was like, well, I don't know, because I have a kid too, and I don't know what I'm doing on any given day, and I need advice and support and help as well. But eventually I entertained the idea of helping any family, and I started doing virtual sessions back in 2016 before it was popular, right?
Yeah.
And then after about a year or two of doing that, I was like, I'm noticing some common themes that I'm saying to every parent, regardless of what their challenges with their kiddos are at home. So I started watching back hundreds of hours of one-on-one coaching with my families, and I pulled out three common themes. And so really what I hope I'm answering your question, I'm kind of going all over, but you said we'd kind of
hear the three common themes now.
Do the dance. Yeah. So I pulled out three common themes, and those were, and literally these three things are a foundation for you as the parent to shift your mindset around your role as the parent. It's not a how-to for every specific behavior challenge you're going through, but it's how you can get your poop in a group and get yourself back on track to be the leader that you need to be and to find the resources or the other things that are going to help and suit your child, right? Their needs. So the three steps are seek first to understand. Why is my child behaving the way they're behaving? And I can tell you that like 90% of the time, it's not the behavior that you're seeing. It's not the lying, the stealing, the alcohol use, the wet noodle tantrum on the Target, you know, floor or whatever. It is, there's something else going on underneath there. And so we really need to figure out what is it? Why would they behave the way they're behaving? Something's going on. And why am I the parent responding or reacting, most times it's reacting, to my child's behavior. So we got to get to that first, seek first to understand. Then step two, we prepare for the worst. Now, we can't always be prepared. Life throws us curveballs. Our kids most certainly do. But there are those day in and day out challenges that we know are going to happen when we pick them up from school, when we tell them no, when we try to get them to bed at night. That those are the things that we can actually prepare for. And I say look forward to, because when you're prepared for it, you can be like, yeah, bring it on. I know how to handle this one. I know how to respond, so that we respond instead of react, right? So prepare for the worst, that worst fear, that worst thing that like, oh, if my kid did that, I'd be so stinking mad. Or I'm so scared my kid is going to do that. Well, think about if that actually happened. Prepare for that. Most times you won't have to even be that as prepared, but and it won't happen. But let's just be prepared so you don't have to be fearing it. You don't have to be frustrated about it. You can be confident in case it does happen. And then step three is to change the conversation with our kids. I believe, Jesse, I think we're in the same court here, that we're giving our kids way too much unconditional praise. So much so that they don't believe it themselves. So that's the caveat there. Like sometimes parents will be like, what? I thought I was supposed to give my kid unconditional praise. Yes, you are. Not if you have to, if you're doing it to convince or to coddle or to pave the way, the smooth path for your child to never fall on their face or never have to pick themselves up or deal with hard things. Then we're doing them a disservice. So I teach about conditional praise, conditional positives, factual positives before we pour on the unconditional. And then I also teach about the difference between empathy and sympathy. We are not to be feeling sorry for our kids all the time. We want to empathize with them, which empowers them instead of making them a victim.
Wow, it's so good. Do you have something that you call those three things? Is it
That's what I call, it's the three steps to becoming a no problem parent. So after I created those three steps, I was like, what am I going to call this? And that's when I was thinking about no problem, how my mom used to say no problem. And she didn't mean no problem like, oh, no problem, I'll take care of that for you, honey. She meant like if I said no, I wasn't going to do something, she'd say, oh, no problem. And that meant, uh-oh, mom's going to handle it, and it's probably not going to be in my best interest, or it's probably not going to be something I'm going to be happy about. So I thought, I'm going to look up the word problem. What does problem mean? If you look it up in the dictionary, a problem is a matter or a situation that is unwelcome or harmful and needing to be dealt with and overcome. And so I was like, all right, I get this. We're turning this into no problem. So any problem that you have out there, parents, in today's world, in your living room, in your school, in your what, any problem can be turned into a no problem. And my three steps are the foundation to help you get there. So here at No Problem Parenting, that's what we do.
We turn any problem into no problem. I love it. The one that stood out to me there at the end when you said empathy over sympathy. And I feel like that's one I've had to really work on in my own life is to be like, you know, because my first instinct, and I think part of it's just being old school, being a guy, is like, these kids are so soft today. Everything, you know, is a disorder. They're labeling themselves. They have the upper hand. And, you know, compared to when we grew up, we walked up the hill both ways in the snow. You know, they got it so easy. And that's not wrong. It is very easy in some metrics, but I think it's even harder to be a teen today dealing with social media, the internet, and just a ever-changing technological modern world. So I love that one. I'm curious, of all these families and parents and teens that you work with, I'm always looking for patterns. Like, what are things that I'm hearing on a larger scale, and is there a bigger type of thing going on? Are there some common themes that you see outside of the three that we just talked about that a lot of parents are struggling with or that you help them with?
Yeah, I think a big one is defiance and just not like independence. Parents will either call it defiance or they'll say, my kid's super independent. Now, when we're talking about a lot of toddlers are independent, right? That's they're moving from the need stage, the first year of life need stage, to the want stage. I want it. And their brain isn't developed enough to, you know, it's like, I want it. I'm going to take it. And it's our job as parents to teach them, that's not exactly how it works, right? But a lot of parents nowadays aren't stopping that. They're not setting the structure and the boundary because we're being taught to let our children lead the play and let our children lead the way and follow their lead and all of that. And so we've got a lot of really independent kids out there that we're doing a big disservice to. We're actually setting the stage like you can just do whatever you want. And we're here for you and we'll make it, you know, we'll make sure you're okay. And we'll get you, you know, we'll meet every want, not every need. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. It does feel sometimes to me like the children, how do they say it? The inmates are running the asylum. Do you feel like there's too much labeling going on today when it comes to whatever it is, ADHD, OCD, ODD? Do we over prescribe these labels today, or do kids over prescribe them? What say you on that?
Oh my gosh, that's a loaded question. It's a yes and a no. I think diagnoses are super beneficial when we've tried a lot of different things. We don't have an answer. We don't know what it is. We need to go. It's like you wouldn't want the doctor to treat you for heart disease when you have cancer. But yep. You need to know specifics. So I don't want a child to be treated or taken care of for oppositional defiant disorder when they actually have reactive attachment disorder. That's a big one. And a lot of times we won't diagnose reactive attachment disorder because that specific diagnosis, the break in attachment has to be before the first 3 years, and really the first two years or in utero. And so oftentimes they won't diagnose it at 10, when if they were treating that diagnosis better, or like for if they were treating the child for that diagnosis, that would help that child and family way more than if they're just treating them for oppositional defiant disorder. But as far as labeling, I think labeling in general has often turned from just like discovering what the needs of the child is to an excuse almost sometimes. I say that lightly, mm-hmm. but you hear kids a lot these days are, oh, I'm so anxious, and everything's so anxious. And then you'll ask them about their feelings, and they won't actually be telling you what they're feeling. They'll be telling you thoughts. Mm. So Dr. J.J. Kelly is the go-to for me on thoughts versus feelings. I love her for teaching, like, anytime you say a word or say a phrase of, like, if you say, I feel like I'm being attacked all the time, or I feel like kids are putting me down, I feel like nobody likes me, that's not a feeling. That's a thought. That's an opinion or an observation or an interpretation of something, right? I feel happy. Yeah. I feel sad. I feel guilt. I feel shame. You know, those are feelings, right? So, when it comes to labeling, I mean, that's, like I said, it's a loaded question. You just sparked a bazillion different things I could talk about when you mentioned labels. But it seems like people need to identify with a label or identify with something to be a part of a group or to feel belonging. I teach with my program and helping parents teach their kids to go inward and think about who it is that you want to be. What are your gifts? What are your skills? What are your talents? What are your desires? What are you interested in? And then let's focus on that, not so much all this other external, what we think we should be or should become, or who we can become if we're with this group or we're in this certain pod, does that make sense?
Yeah. It just got me thinking. One of the things that I hear a lot is that kids are lonely. They're having trouble making mm-hmm. real friends. Like mm-hmm. this is something I've heard multiple times this week, is they think that everything's going well, or they've just accepted that this is how their life is going to be, but they don't have any real friends that they hang out with outside of school, and they're withdrawn and they're lonely. What mm-hmm. would you advise parents that find themselves in this situation with their teenager?
Well, first of all, where's the conversation, and how is the conversation going with your kids, and what are you asking? What kind of questions are you asking, and how are you communicating and just being even present or in the same room with your child? Are they willing to share why they think that is, that they don't have friends? Are screens constantly attached to you and your child? Isolation is a big one, especially since COVID. It was there before COVID, but we all got kind of lax during COVID. Even if we had limits on screen time and, social media use and TV watching and all of that, that kind of got thrown out the window about 3 months into COVID. People were like, I don't really care. Just do whatever you got to do. I got to work from home, or I just need a break from you. Right. But I think I have two families currently that I'm working with where kids are older teens. and they're isolating and they're not communicating. Well, they're communicating now. They've been working with me for just a couple of months, and the kids are finishing up their school, getting college credits, and they're interested in getting a job or out seeking a job. And the parents are not harping on them anymore. And they're not over worrying. Usually you have one parent that's just harping, you got to get out and you got to do more. And they're pushing. And then you got another parent who's like, just leave them go. They just want their alone time. They're okay. Don't push them into something they don't want to do. So I just begin with, where's the conversation around that? And empowering the kid. It has to start with pointing out the things they're good at, with conditional positives, by the way. You say, I don't have any friends, nobody wants to hang out with me, rather than convincing the kid, oh, you have lots of friends, and you start naming them all off, they maybe don't. And do they know what it means to be a good friend? Do they even pursue other kids? Do they initiate conversations, right? And so sometimes it's about saying, pointing it out. You know, the other day when Joe fell, you guys were on the basketball court and Joe fell and scunned his knee, you ran over there to make sure he was okay. That's what a good friend does. I think you're a good friend. That's a conditional positive, mm-hmm. right? And then pouring on the unconditional on top of that. So pointing out what it means to be a good friend, but then also encouraging them, not coddling them and saying, yeah, so are you a good friend or maybe you're not a good friend? And what does that look like? How do you interact with the kids at school? What are you interested in? Are you all about you and not inquiring about the other person and asking them what their interests are? Is it a one-sided conversation? Yeah, I'm kind of going all over with this. Sorry, Jesse.
No, you're
excited. You gotta cut that out.
I love it. No, I love it. It's, I think like you're saying, kids are so much more perceptive, and that's why it's important to have that conditional praise, right? Mm-hmm. Where if you say these things that aren't true, they know that innately deep down in their bones, they know, yeah, she just has to say that because she's my mom, or he just mm-hmm. has to say that because he's my dad. And so it's so interesting. I am curious about the type of parent who is so worried and pressuring them that they aren't going to be able to get into that school, that they aren't doing enough, their grades aren't high enough. How do you work with those parents to take their foot off the accelerator a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when our kids are little, that toddler age, we cannot wait for them to be able to wipe their own butt and buckle their own car seat and tie their own shoes and do all the things. And then as they hit the preteen years and the teen years, we start to pull in the reins and we're like, oh, no, you can't go with that kid because we don't know their parents. And oh, no, you can't stay out that late because you have this, that, or the other tomorrow. And no, you can't have that phone, or you can't have that social media app. It's a bunch of no's when that's the age we should be pushing them towards all those things. We should be encouraging them to do all the scary things with guidance and caution and some boundaries, right? But we need to be more encouraging and building them up like, you can do that. Oh, I'm excited for you to try that. I can't wait for you to go. And that begins on the monkey bars on the playground. Instead of saying, get down from there, it's too high, go higher. You're there. You're right there. So, you know, yeah. You're not leaving the kid to climb, you know, 10 feet high when you're not around. But that's the kind of thing where we need to be encouraging and empowering our kids, because that's where confidence is built and not anxiety. I think anxiety is through the roof. I mean, with all the supports we have in this world, anxiety is through the roof. And I think the number one common denominator of that are hovering and worried parents.
Easier said than done. But I agree. There's definitely
it an isn't epidemic easy.
Of kids.
Yeah. And it isn't easy. And it scares the bejesus out of me on any given day. I mean, I remember a time when our son, who's a great kid, he was hanging around some kids where I was like, oh, I don't think that's a good idea. And I don't like the decisions they're making. And I don't like the choices they're making. And I don't like how, you know, dangerous the one was and how goofy the other one was. Like, just troublemaking in various forms, right? I could have said, no, Andrew, you can't hang out with those kids. But I didn't. I said, geez, Andrew, you know, I'm sure hopeful that when you're hanging out with X, Y, or Z, that some of you wears off on them. Mm. Because I know that my kid is a good influencer. And I believe that in him. And he can screw up. He has screwed up. He's not perfect. He's made mistakes. all of which he could recover from, and all of which I'm super glad that he made in the comfort of our home with our guidance as a teenager, because it decreases the odds that he's going to make even bigger mistakes when he leaves the nest. Well, he's left the nest, but you know, like, so yeah. We want, it's the messaging that we're sending our kids. Are we sending messages that they're capable? Are we sending, you know, messages that we believe that they'll make the good choices when they're in crowds of people or atmospheres with others that aren't making good choices? I can guarantee you, your child can have a best friend where you know the parents tightly and super great, and you have all the trust in the world that your daughter and her other friend are going to hang out and have the best time, and they're getting on social media and talking to perps overseas, and you have no idea, right? Because you're so trusting of them, because it wouldn't make sense for them to do that. Kids do stupid things. The best of kids do stupid things. And sometimes the kids who have had it the hardest, who have been in the most trouble, who are the, you know, naughtiest of kids, actually come out to be the higher achievers and the more confident kids, because they've dealt with the tough stuff, you know? They've had to pull themselves up and recover.
Yeah. Yeah, you're really preparing them. You're really preparing them for life as an adult, where they can stand on their own two feet. And they don't need the hovering mom, the hovering dad to be there to protect them every step as they're going through life. And the only way to do that is to go out and experience these things and fall and be like, oh, that hurt. I didn't like that. Oh, I got a scratch. Oh, I need a Band-Aid. But I love how you pair it with guidance in the home and you believing in them. And even just how you framed it of like, oh, stay away from these kids. They're bad. It's like, I hope that you're able to rub off on them and be a good influence because you're a good kid and you are a leader and you bring all these good qualities. And I'd hope that that is the more predominant factor in your guys' relationship. I think that is, it's very intentional.
It is. It is. And I think a big reason why I came to that way of parenting myself is the experiences that I had working with kids on that attachment spectrum, we'll call it, who were often the bullies. Give me a bully any day. Those are my jam. I want those bullies. There is a reason. Again, 90% of the behavior is not the root of the is not the real reason. Like just reprimanding a kid or giving them more consequences, or you know, that's No. Let's get to the root of why are they even behaving the way they feel or the way they are. And often the bullies are behaving the way they are because they feel rejection. They feel pain and they want other people to feel the same kind of pain and hurt that they feel. So it's not an excuse, right? There are consequences for everything. But I think we've got it kind of wrong and backwards a little bit on how we are responding to both the bully and the child who's been bullied. We're coddling the victim and we're separating and pushing away the perpetrator. And there is a middle ground for both. And I teach parents how to do that in whatever scale they're dealing with in their home with the behaviors. I teach you how to come to kind of that middle ground. Whether you're the drill sergeant parent or you're the helicopter or the lawnmower parent, I'm going to help you figure out how to kind of meet in the middle and be that confident leader and empower your kids.
Yeah. It's that hurt people, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't it so funny with the bullies? And when you look at it, so often those people that are having a hard time and are bullying, like you said, who are your jam, it's like, yeah, if you knew what was going on in their life, in their home, it almost always is, there's something bigger and you're like, oh, well, now I just feel bad for you. Even though I'm the person you're bullying, I get why you're doing it.
Yeah. You know? And I tell bullies too, that when I and I don't even like the word bully and I'm using it so much today, but you know, kids who have had it rough and who have, whether they've been through trauma, abuse, neglect, just severe situations. When I've met with those kids back in my counseling days, and even now, every now and then I'll meet with a teen, I let them know a little bit of my background, what I can do. I educate them if they have a diagnosis or they have whatever going on in their life. And then I say, and I will always want to make sure that I promise them one thing. And that is that I promise you, kiddo, I will never feel sorry for you. And then I pause. And what do you think the response is from that kid? Like, well, that's kind of mean.
Yeah.
You know, look at me like, you don't care about why me? Wouldn't you feel sorry for me? But what good? Yeah. I can feel very sorry for what happened to you and the things that happened in your life, but I'm going to promise you not to feel sorry for you just in general, because that's not empowering. That's going to keep you in that story and in that situation, that thing that happened to you. And that is not who you are, nor who you will become, right? There's something to be taught out of that. And I'm saying this, it can sound like I'm saying it lightly, but I'm truly not. I've seen some horrific things. And honestly, a lot of the kiddos that I've served that have been abused and neglected and through trauma and loss, just tragic loss, have grown to be some of the most incredible, empathetic and understanding and just high achieving people. And some of the kiddos that have been indulged, spoiled, have never had a need, you know, or want for anything, have grown up and they hit college and they bomb out and they're just lost and they don't know what to do, because all along they've just never really had to work on anything for themselves, right? They've always had somebody there paving the way or making things easier on them.
Yeah. And in turn, it's hurting them more than it's helping them. It's a little counterintuitive, but isn't that funny? I see the same thing. So many of the people that I know and admire and look up to, they are people who went through the hardest of hard things and the most difficult and unfortunate situations, but they rose through the concrete like the rose, and they turned their life into something great. And they said, you know what? I'm not going to let anything stop me. And that's why I think getting rid of this victim mindset and this victim culture where people just make it a full-time job to complain and just say how the world's not fair. Right. The world's not fair. It isn't.
It's and not that's a circus either.
Yeah.
My mom used to say that. We'd be like, it's not fair. And she'd say, it's not a circus either, honey. It's like, it's not a fair. It's not a circus either. And don't sweat the small stuff, because it's all small stuff. You can get through it.
It's all just a stage. You know, would you mind sharing one of your favorite success stories of a family, a parent, or a teen that you've worked with? And I'm sure there's so many, but if there was one that popped into your mind right when I said that, I would love to hear it, because I feel like there's just so much negativity and, you know, the next few, you know, rest of the year is going to be people fighting over the next presidency. And I just like to focus on the things that are just amazing and beautiful. And so would you mind sharing with us?
All right. I'm going to share Elizabeth then, because she, not her real name, but I share about her all the time. I get a little emotional when I talk about it, but she is the person, her family is the family that really launched me into the world of mental health. I was prior to that, I was working with kids with disabilities, but Elizabeth was a 10-year-old little girl. I had been asked to go meet with their family to help them. She had reactive attachment disorder. I didn't know what that was. I walked onto the family's wooden front porch and I knocked on the door. And the stepmom opened up the door and she said, here she is. She's all yours. Dad and I are going out for a break. And I thought, whoa, no wonder why this girl has problems. These parents are like super strict and intense. Well, I had later learned that Elizabeth had been tantruming for 2.5 hours before I got to the family's home. And so her parents' intense greeting of me was out of a much needed break. So reactive attachment disorder is often not visible to others. The parents see the behaviors, the rejection, the fear, the anger, all of the things. And what ended up happening is Elizabeth was bright. She was a straight A student. She was super cute. You know, she was fun to be around with other kids and all that, but she was suffering from reactive attachment disorder and no one really wanted or knew how to help her. So when her parents would say all these dangerous behaviors were happening at home, no one believed them. They were like, she's totally fine here, until she got a little bit older and her true colors started to shine through and leak out into school and different places. Well, long story short, she ended up in lots of residential facilities and different things. And her family and I fought to find, what is it with this diagnosis back in 1990 or 92? What is this diagnosis? What does this all mean? Why isn't traditional therapy helping? And when we learned of the diagnosis, we did everything we could to research and find out how to help her. Ended up raising a ton of money to get her the therapy she needed. And I kind of held in there with the family over the course of 5 years or so. And then all of a sudden, one day she was about 13 or 14, and her mom's sitting at the table with me, and she said, Jackie, do you think she will ever trust me? Do you think she and I will ever have a relationship with each other? All of these things we've tried. Now we've sent her away for this intensive therapy, right? Am I ever going to have a relationship with my daughter? And I said, you know what, Mom? I don't know. Maybe someday when she's 25, she's going to call you up and she's going to say, hey, Mom, let's have coffee. The family were big coffee drinkers. She said, let's have coffee. No kidding. This girl, 10 years pass, right? Maybe more than that. I get a call, random phone call from a girl. It's Elizabeth. She said, hey, Jackie, it's Elizabeth. Don't hang up. Because, you know, she had been really tough in my days of working with her. And she said, I just wanted to call you and let you know that I'm all grown up now and I'm pregnant with my first child. And I wanted to thank you because my mom and I have a really great relationship. And you were the catalyst. You were one of those people that stuck in there with us. Even though at the time it seemed like nothing was working, no one was reaching me, nothing was getting through, I got goosebumps on my arms. You hung in there with us. You kept supporting my mom and dad. And that was the key. She said, I wanted to thank you for supporting my mom and dad all those years ago. Because they were desperate. They were shunned by a lot of people. People were judging them for how they were parenting her and what they weren't doing and were doing and all the things. And I said, you know what, Elizabeth, I want to thank you too for the fire that you lit in me to help me make it my mission to support parents who are struggling with their kids. So it's the coolest thing. I mean, years of therapy and treatment and approaches and all the things that family had tried. Hang in there, parents. Reach out and find the right support, the right thing, the next thing. Even if the last thing didn't work, there is always a way. There is always something out there. And unfortunately, we don't always know what that thing is, right? Or we don't have access to it. But there is always a way. There's something out there, someone out there that can help you to help your kid.
I love that story. One thing that we talk about so much here is the key to living is giving. And as you're telling that story and you're getting a little emotional and the smile on your face, mm-hmm. It is just so apparent that your life was as impacted as Elizabeth's was in that time. And just the fulfillment, I just want and wish that for all people. And no matter what they're going through, and when we're so focused on all the time on it's about us and we need help and we're having a hard time, if you can swap that mindset, whether you're a parent or you are a teen, mm-hmm. and go, how can I help other people? What can I do of service to someone else, big or small? It doesn't have to be a big thing. But that feeling, there's nothing close to it. There's no amount of money or check in the mail to feeling that fulfillment of doing something for someone else. And I just think it puts you in that state of gratitude. It makes your problems seem not as big and bad as you think they are, because you're like, oh, these people would give anything to have a relationship with their child or their parent that I have in my own family. And it's such an awesome thing. And I always joke around and say, like, I feel like we're like Johnny Appleseeds.
Yeah, because I know.
You're planting these seeds, and we'll have kids that come in, and in 90 days, they have a complete transformation. And it's incredible. It still blows my mind. We just had two parent calls this week, and I didn't know what the feedback was going to be because I'm not at home with them every day. And it just blows my mind. But other kids, like what you're doing is, I've heard it called kids spell trust. T-I-M-E. Mm-hmm. So you're putting in time, and that can be one goofy conversation about a boy that they like. It can be watching some stupid werewolf movie that you're not into at all, but they're into. But spending that time and showing that you care, and those seeds that you planted will come to fruition later in life. And you're like, oh, like I've had that with kids just early on with speaking, and you know, you leave, but then 4 or 5 years later, you get a message and they're like, I got off antidepressants. I realized I could change my attitude and it was up to me and I could take action. So I that story just made me so happy, and I appreciate you sharing.
Well, and look at that, her story, all the struggles, all the things, not that I mean, I'm just so grateful for, I turned that family down 4 times. I was like, I went and looked up reactive attachment disorder. I was like, I don't know anything about this. I cannot help this family. Nobody else could. Yeah. The fourth call, I'm like, well, maybe God knows something I don't. Like, I'm supposed to meet this family. And 30 years later, I help families now who have kiddos in that same kind of situation who can turn rage on and off, you know, as fast as a light yeah. switch on your wall, deal with. And so Elizabeth, her purpose on earth, aside from all the amazing things she's doing now in her life and giving back and helping others and all of that, there's so much purpose to her life. And even when we couldn't have imagined what is the purpose of her, you know, like raging like this and being destructive and harmful and hurtful and all of that, that wasn't really her. That was, you know, a cause of her early life experience before she got to be with dad and stepmom. So, yeah, it's there's just so much. And again, I can't say enough for what you're doing, Jesse, for those kids, because even if the parents aren't on board, you're providing that belief for those kids. Like, oh, there is another way with your story of just resilience and perseverance and determination.
Yeah, it is interesting because I think the ultimate message is it's in you. It's in you. Yeah. You have the power to make the decision, to make the change. You don't need a guru. You know, you don't need these other things. You can make that decision. It's not a good business plan. I'll tell you that much. But that's our goal when we work with parents and we work with kids. Mm-hmm. And as I know it is yours, it's like, we don't want you to have to go to a therapist once a week for the next 10 years, because then you're just still dependent on this outside thing. Like, we can work on dealing with some trauma, some detachments. We can give you tools and these things. And yes, we're here. We're not your family now. We're not going to abandon you. You can come and share, and we'll have the parents come and share things that are going on in their relationships and their families. And, yeah. and that's, it's really cool because it's community. It's coming back to that community. I wanted to ask you, though, before I forget, I'm real curious your perspective on this, given your background. Do you feel like sometimes therapy can be reinforcing a negative behavior, which is focusing on your past or things that you are frustrated and unhappy with in your life all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I'm not knocking therapy because there are amazing therapeutic resources out there. And there are therapies that can just kind of keep you going. And if you're not seeing, if you're in therapy for 5 years because your therapist is your go-to person where you can dump, you can vent, you can air, and then you can keep moving and your life is great. And that, more power to you. That's absolutely wonderful. That's the kind of therapist you know you want to have. They're there because you know what you want out of it and you're getting what you want out of it and life is good. But if you're going to, if you're sending your child to a therapist and you're still saying, nothing's changing at home, my relationship isn't any better, the child's grades are declining, we still don't, you know, like, why are you going? So I caution parents, not caution, but I say, hey, and I teach this in my program, why is your kid going to therapy? What is the therapy your child needs? What is what does the child expect to get out of therapy? Do they know what therapy is and what it's for and why they're going? You know, families that get divorced, they'll say to their child, the divorce is not your fault. And the child, and I've had more than one kiddo say this in a session before, in a meeting before, then why am I the one in therapy? Because parents will get divorced and they feel bad and they don't know how to talk to their kids and they're feeling like, well, their kids are sad. Well, of course they're sad, you know, and they're having this guilt. And now maybe the child's not doing well in school. So then the parents send the child to therapy. Did the child want to go to therapy? Does the child know why they're there? So yes, again, many answers to that question. But I also, another really, I think the most powerful example I can give you is of a 4-year-old that I knew who was in play therapy after experiencing quite a bit of trauma. Now, as you know, littles can't always verbalize what they're thinking or what they're feeling. And that's true if your trauma was in that first 3 years of life or earlier. Even when you're 10 or 12 or 14, you can't verbalize exactly because when the trauma happened to you, it was pre-verbal memory, right? Mm-hmm. And so a 4-year-old was in play therapy. I'm not a particular fan of the actual play therapy for attachment issues, but she was wrapping the mommy doll up in a rope, like a string, like a rope, and then setting the mommy doll on fire. That was very telling for that therapist, right? Like, okay, this girl's got some really dark feelings about mom. There's got to be some trust or attachment issues in there. What was disheartening even more than just learning that is that time and time again, week and week again, the therapist allowed the child to do that. Almost like sending the message to the child that, yes, it would be okay to tie mommy up and start her on fire.
Yeah.
Geez. Now, that's maybe too deep and dark for this show, Jesse, but that's some of the stuff that happens with traumatic experiences that kids go through, right? Which can lead into other things. So, yes, we can do a disservice with kids in therapy sometimes when we're constantly having them bring those things up or talk about them or acknowledging them as if that's truth, what they're thinking or feeling is truth. And I want to be careful again on how I say that, because this is very general and broad, so I don't need a bunch of people going, hey Jackie, therapy is, but I have had kids who don't want to go because they don't want to talk about their sexual abuse for the third time with the second therapist because they're not getting better and mom and dad are switching therapists, right? There are other therapies out there where the person, the victim, the trauma survivor doesn't have to talk about, the trauma over and over again. Like EMDR is a great one. And here at No Problem Parenting, that's what I'm all about, helping you find the resources that you have access to from your home that are going to be an alternative to maybe some of the things that you don't have in your area, but maybe aren't close to or don't like, or that you don't have in your area at all. It's like towards the end of my day, I start to stutter because I have so many things I want to share with you. But the other thing is, when we're entertaining kids coming into therapy sessions because they're depressed or they're anxious, those are probably, it's like, you should feel better after a while, especially if they're being medicated for those things. You should be feeling better. You should be seeing some progress after 3-6 months for sure. And if you're not, gosh, there's got to be something else. And I always say that one of the first things you should do if your child's experiencing anxiety or depression is you got to find a place for them to volunteer. You've got to find a place for them to get somewhere else, because when you're dealing with, and I'm living proof of this, anxiety or depression, I've had it, I've been through it, I've dealt with it. You're all about you in those moments. You can't see anything else, anybody else. You're just so consumed with what's wrong with me or all the negative thoughts that are going on in your head. And one of the best ways that doesn't really cost you anything other than the ride to get your kid there is to get them volunteering or out into some other kind of activity where they're able to help and get the subject off of them and onto something else.
Man, I love it. Change it from I'm someone who needs help to I'm someone who helps other people. I believe in it, and I've seen it change so many lives. So I love, love, love that so much. I've been wanting to ask you, do you have parents that are like, the issue that I'm having with my child is their cell phone, technology, social media? Is that something that's coming up a lot?
And all so, the time.
What do you say to those parents?
Well, so first of all, it's again, how have you set the boundaries or the structure or whatever around cell phones? Are we just, all of a sudden the kid turns 10 and we hand him a cell phone, and have we put any security things on the phone, or what have we done? And it's all great to say, oh, you can use a cell phone at this age, and then you can have social media at this age, and you have like these age parameters on it. We have to do way more. Start with a contract, a paper contract. What are the parameters and the boundaries and the thing? Put it on the contract so that if anything is tested, if any waters are tested or any rules are broken on it, you don't have to be the bad guy. You can go back to the contract and say, oh, you made fun of some kid in a text message or on Snapchat, if they had that, or on whatever, right? And it came back. Oh, what does it say about that? Like phones taken away. privilege is taken away, or that app is gone, or, you know, whatever it is. You don't have to be the bad guy then and be all worked up about it. It can be very matter of fact and cause and effect. But I also encourage parents to be excited about technology. We go, in our whole world, we tend to go to the negative for everything. So I turn problems into no problem. So if technology and cell phone is a problem, how do we turn it into a no problem? We be excited about all the things that technology has to offer us, all the things that the social media platforms have to offer us, all the options and availability of looking something up when you're stumped on a problem in school, you know, and being able to search for an answer or an idea or a definition. Like, let's focus on all the really good things about it, more than, as much or more than, we are focusing on all the negative. Because I frankly am one that's tired of hearing all the negative effects of social media. No kidding.
Yeah.
But we've been talking about it since the VCR days. It's just a different thing. True. And now we're exposed to so much more. So there's greater fear. Now we've got more fear, fear, fear. Anything you are afraid for, I want you to do step two of no problem parenting and prepare for the worst. And then you backtrack. What do I need? How do I need to present this to my child so that I'm not just coming off as the nagging, fearful parent? I've got some proof in there. I've got some facts, and I've got some, hey, you've got this cell phone now. You're going to need to be aware of some of the things that can happen. Did you know that somebody could actually message you on Instagram and say that if you don't show them a picture of your genitalia, they're going to kill themselves? Are we having those kind of conversations with our kids? That happens every single, thousands of times a day. And boys are sending pictures of their genitalia to these people, you know, posing as teenage girls that are super depressed, and getting them to do that. Then they come back at you and they say, if you don't take this picture, if you don't do this, now I've got your information. I've got this one picture. I'm going to post it everywhere on social media. Send me this much money and I won't post your picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like whatever the, that's again, I use extreme examples because I don't like the fluff, Jesse. I don't like all the, you know, whatever, what's wrong with our kids. I like to get to the dirt, the real life dirt, the icky, sticky, tricky situations that parents are dealing with. And so, you know, with our teenagers, we need to be saying, hey, did you hear that can happen? But also setting up that contract and then helping them be aware of the responsibility that comes with it and how excited we are for them to hit this next phase of their life.
Yeah.
You see how that's even different?
Yeah. Yeah. The framing of it is so much more positive, upbeat. And this is a great thing. Of course, there's going to be systems around it. There's going to be guidelines. We're going to come up with rules together. There's going to be a contract because that's how everything works in life. But this is going to be really awesome. And as long as you follow the rules and do all the right things and aren't using it to waste your time or hurt yourself or other people, then this can be an awesome tool
like
for you.
Like anything else in no problem parenting, as long as it doesn't become a wedge in our relationship, we're good. Have at it. And I would prefer, I was the parent that had a candy dish on my dining room table at almost all times. And my sister would say, there's no way you could have that candy dish with my nephew over. And I said, well, my candy dish is on my table. So when he comes over, like it's there. So he might get too much sugar if he decides to hoard it or, you know, gouge it or whatever. But I think he'll figure it out then. He might get a tummy ache. I would not remove that candy dish. And we taught our son, how does your stomach feel when you eat too much candy? So, you know, all growing up, I never had to worry about him overindulging in any of that stuff. It was get enough till you feel full or enough until, you know, your tummy doesn't hurt or enough to appease you in that moment. But often the more we restrict stuff, the more the kids want it. And that's true with us adults. And the more fear we put around it, the more enticing it is to want to learn more. That's true. Yeah. Look at our whole world right now. Everybody's, you know, looking at the fear-based headlines before the feel-good headlines. So I say, like, let's lead with giving the kids the opportunity to figure some things out themselves. And again, social media, you got to have parameters. You got to have guidelines, especially depending on what age you're letting your kids have those. Start with a dumb phone, work up to the smartphone, but definitely have the contract. And then I also like, because then you can matter-of-factly say, of course there's going to be parameters. Of course there's going to be guidelines. You know, of course you're going to have your phone plugged in the charger at night and not in your room, because I don't want some predator on a social media page looking at you in your bedroom when I'm not around. I mean, like, duh. You just kind of phrase it to the kids like that. And they yell at you and they say, oh, you're so old fashioned, or my friends don't have to, you know, you're happy to move in with them. I can call their parents and see if they have a spot for you. But here in the Finneman house, this is how we do things. You know, and it's just very nonchalant. The kids can get upset, you guys. We don't have to.
Yeah.
You know, we can understand when they're upset by something we say no to or do, but we don't have to engage and share that emotion or match that emotion.
Yeah. You're in control of your own emotions. And I think it is so interesting, because it is how you lay it out. And you're like, yeah, if you don't make a big deal of it. And I would argue that a lot of these things are what you do because you love your kid. And it's not to say that, you know, Jimmy down the road, whose parents let him have everything and all access to their phone and go anywhere at any time of night, it's like, well, they clearly don't care what happens to their kid as much as they should if they're allowing them to put themselves in this situation. Mm-hmm. And that excuse that you even use as your example is something that you hear so much. And it's like, but all the other kids are doing this or that or the other thing. And you're like, when the thing that we used to say when you were a kid is like, oh, well, if everyone else jumped off a bridge,
would you
jump off a bridge? And so it's the same thing now as adults. It's like, yeah, if the kids were off smoking crack or robbing banks or joining gangs, would the excuse, well, everyone else is doing it, would you be okay with it? No. But for some reason, when it comes to technology, the phone and social media, parents just give in so much easier. So showing them that they love them is putting up some boundaries and not allowing them to do anything because you care. And that's your role as a parent. Yeah. I love it. I love it, because the answer can't be just take the phone away altogether, because at some point they're going to turn 18, hopefully go off on their own. And if they're just like, okay, now I can have the thing that I was never allowed to have, and they just dive full into it, they got to learn how to manage it. They got to learn to have systems. They got to learn to know how to have a little bit of candy and monitor it on their own and be okay and navigate life as an adult.
Yeah, exactly. I remember, I'm 50. I remember being a young teen, probably a tween, and asking my mom over and over and over to go to a specific friend's house. And she'd be like, no, you're not going there. Don't know the parents. Well, I got smart. I just said, hey, mom, can I go to Amy's? And I made a plan to go to Amy's. And Amy told her mom we were going to Amy's. And then what did Amy and I do? Snuck out at night and went over to Sue's house, you know, because her parents were sleeping and they didn't really pay attention and hover and protect, right? So we found a way to get around it. That's not changed in the last, you know, 30 some years, right? Kids are still doing that. Is that the real? And my mom was a great mom and I had a great relationship with her, but she, you know, wasn't having those conversations with me about why is that so important for you to go there and what are the expectations and, you know, how can I know that I can trust you and what happens if you do something that, you know, you shouldn't be doing and you're with that kid. And I just told you I didn't want you to go with that kid because I knew you were going to do something you shouldn't be doing. And then what if that happens? Are you going to trust me enough to call me? I mean, that's a real conversation that parents need to have. Are you going to trust me enough to call me? You know, you tell your kids don't drink. You tell them, you know, to be home on time. You tell them to. But if they don't, if they do get into something that they have promised you they wouldn't do, and they mess up, do they trust you enough to call you and to say, I messed up, come get me?
Yeah. Those courageous conversations need to be had beforehand.
Yes. And exactly the prepare for the worst, exactly what you think, like have the conversation with your kid and role play it and see how they respond to it. And then, it's a good way to kind of prepare for the worst and change the conversation. Yeah.
One more question for you.
Okay.
Thank you so much for all that you've been sharing. This has been amazing. If you were going to go over and start your parenting journey all over again, you're starting back from the beginning. What would be your number one piece of advice to yourself, knowing what you know now?
To myself? I was going to say the number one thing I wouldn't do any again is a stupid timer for timeouts. Throw those out the window. But for me, I would just say, don't worry about what the other parents are saying. Stay true to yourself. I think in the early years, especially when my son was younger, I was wanting to do it all right. And I was watching what other parents were doing, what they had for their kids, the opportunities they were giving their kids, the things. And I think I was in the early years, I was thinking, I need to be doing that. I need to be doing that. I need to be doing that. And it was probably our son's middle age years where I was like, I'm done with this. Like we have our own morals and values and beliefs in our home, and his friends and families and all the school people in it have theirs. And I don't need to buy into all of that or jump on board with all of that. I can stay true to our family's values, beliefs, and morals and raise our son this way. You are giving your kids a foundation. They can choose later on in life which direction they want to go. And so that's what I would say to myself is don't be so hard on yourself in those early years to get it right and to do it like everybody else is doing it. Stay true to yourself, yeah, as old fashioned as you might be, or as bass backwards as you might be, as I normally am. I'm quirky and I do non-traditional things and crazy, you know, awesome, fun things that parents think are sometimes odd or weird or whatever. And I think my relationship with my kid has thrived because of that. You know, I wasn't just the straight laced, got to do it this way. Or, you know, don't ever do that. You know, we were, so yeah, just, I would say not be too hard on yourself and be confident.
So good. Oh man, I love it. I think that's so relatable because that's something with kids I talk about, especially like middle school age, but high school too. And it's like, they're so worried about what everyone thinks about them, right? It's like, what am I wearing? The pimple on my face. Mm-hmm. And you're like, hey, all those people over there, maybe they think about you a little bit, but they're mostly just worried about what you're thinking about them. Yes. And so everyone's in their own little narcissistic loop bubble. And I always laugh because I go, guess what, guys? It's the same thing for adults. It never goes away. The cars we drive, the watches we wear, the places we live, the person you date or marry. It's like we're all just big kids worrying about what everyone thinks about us. And the happiest people I know are the people that care the least amount, truly, what other people think about them. So I think that's such a good piece of advice for parenting and for life, for young, for old, for everyone. Jackie, where can everyone come to listen to your podcast? You're having awesome, amazing guests. I say that because I was on there.
Yeah.
And also No Problem Parenting. Where's the best place for everyone to go check out all of your stuff?
Everything is at noproblemparents.com. So parents with an S. You can find me on all the socials at No Problem Parents. And the podcast is the podcast is No Problem Parenting. And yeah, I've had over 200 guests. I think we're close to 300 episodes. And I'm providing my own tips and tools and resources on there, but also amazing resources like yours, Jesse, where I want to bring resources that are going to help parents become confident leaders, but also like approaches and, you know, those different types of therapies I was talking about, or books, or self-care, motivation, inspiration for parents themselves, because we got to fill our cup first. And 100%. A lot of parents have a hard time doing that, but we need to fill our cup first. So sharing all the resources and things on the No Problem Parenting podcast.
Awesome. Yay. Well, we'll make sure that we put it below. Everyone, go check it out. Jackie is amazing. And we're just so excited that you were able to join us today. So thank you again.
Thanks so much, Jesse.